Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, I wonder how you feel about spiders or getting on a plane or maybe even going to the dentist. Ew. I haven't felt good about either of those things at points in my life. If they're the kinds of things that make your skin crawl and set off alarm bells in your head, then you could be among the ranks of thousands of Australians who have a phobia. The term phobia comes from the Greek word phobos, which means fear or horror. But how can you tell if you actually have a phobia instead of a more run-of-the-mill type of fear about something? I'm not sure that I have a fear of heights, but I certainly don't like leaning out over the railing of tall buildings. Is that just sense of common sense or something else? Tonight we're going to explore how phobias develop, as well as hear about some of the common phobias that people have and how they're treated. We'll also learn about some of the more some of the more rare types of phobias. There's even a thing called phobophobia, which is a phobia about having phobias, would you believe? Anyway, joining us tonight is clinical psychologist Tamara Cavanett, who in her long career has treated quite a few people with phobias. She's also the newly appointed president of the Australian Psychological Society. Tamara, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Hi, thanks very much for having me, Philip.
Well, tell us, describe what a phobia is. How is it different from just being frightened of something? Or is it the same?
Similar in the sense that we often all have fears, but phobias in particular are persistent and extreme fears. So those that are out of proportion with the actual threat that is posed by, you know, whatever it may be. So for example, you know, a fear of sharks is not a problem unless it's actually out of proportion. You know, you're in a situation where you wouldn't necessarily think that you were in threat.
A fear of sharks seems to be entirely rational.
Yes. Absolutely. So it's more about whether or not you're actually fearing it in a situation where you don't need to.
So, for example, in the kids' wading pool at the beach.
Yes.
I don't know. Yeah. Okay. So it's something that, in other words, it's out of proportion to the threat available, as it were.
Out of proportion to the threat, and very persistent and extreme. So ones that typically have, you know, interfere with the things that you want to get done in life or your normal functioning and tasks.
Okay. There are apparently three main categories, aren't there? There's specific phobias. Mm-hmm. There's social anxiety disorders, which used to be known as social phobias, mm-hmm. and agoraphobias. Tell us about those.
Yeah, sure. So specific phobias are the ones where it can literally be on almost anything possible. So any subject matter you can think of, you could have a specific phobia on, and those are the ones that you mentioned earlier, like arachnophobia and dentophobia, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas social anxiety disorder is usually a fear of negative evaluation by others. So usually you avoid social situations and you're worried about how other people might judge you. And agoraphobia is where you're actually fearing situations that are difficult to escape from. So, you know, small spaces or crowds, those kinds of things. And usually it's alongside panic attacks. So you fear having a panic attack in those moments.
Okay. Because we are cautious and afraid of lots of things, aren't we? I mean, they're generally centered around our safety or fear that we might come to harm if we encounter these things. So all those responses are quite rational, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. So if, you know, part of our fear mechanism is that you are meant to experience fear when you're in a situation of threat. Mm. So it's when you're placed in a situation where it's excessive, where you shouldn't be having a fear, or your response is in excess of what the situation calls for. Yeah. I was just going to say, such as a dentist, most of us don't like going to the dentist. We don't enjoy it. But we don't necessarily have a phobia to the extent that we are fearing it irrationally.
Although somebody with a fear of flying might think it's entirely rational. You know, I'm getting into this machine. I don't know who's I don't know who's at the controls. I don't know what qualifications they have. And it's inherently dangerous. We'll be up at 30,000 feet, and if we fall out of the sky, I'm a goner. what's irrational about that?
So absolutely. So, but your chance of actually having any adverse event while flying is very minimal. So you would have far more driving your car, for example, from A to B, and yet, you know, most of us would drive from A to B with very little thought and very little anxiety.
Mm.
And yet, you know, getting on a plane, a group of individuals would be completely anxious to the point where they would avoid getting on a plane, really struggle to fly. Some people take medications, those kinds of things.
Sure, sure. Yeah, just going back to these three broad categories, specific phobias, social anxiety disorders and agoraphobias. Specific phobia, these are all the things that are exotic. I mean, we talked about arachnophobia, fear of spiders, mm-hmm. you know, claustrophobia, fear of confined spaces, and so on. Well, usually Greek-derived names for lots of these things, aren't they? These, apparently, I read, are at least partly genetic. I found that fascinating. So, in other words, they're either inherited or learnt in families.
Yeah, so we learn off the responses we witness. So there is the possibility that you were exposed to a response from mum or dad that made you think that a certain object or you know, bug, animal, that kind of thing was to be feared, or things that you've heard. So those ones where you're the environment, but also, you know, a fear that they have is one that you can tend to hold.
Right.
And we also don't know a lot about genetics, but we do know that parents with anxiety, it's not, you know, necessarily unusual to also have children with anxiety, that there is some genetic factors as well as the environment that link the two.
Okay, so is it a genetic factor or is it just learnt behaviour? I mean, if dad doesn't like spiders, you know, maybe the kids learn not to like spiders too.
They'll argue most things are both. So with anxiety disorders, that you have to have certain genes triggered by an environmental stimuli. So the, you know, latest in epigenetics would argue that you need both. You need some genetic predisposition towards an anxiety and then an environmental trigger.
I'm just wondering whether we sometimes use the word genetic a bit loosely, don't we? Because I'm just wondering whether it is just behaviour that we learn. That is, I don't know, if you grow up in a family that never cooks and disparages peas, for example, you may well go into adulthood with a strong dislike of peas.
Absolutely.
But that's only because you critically copied your parents.
Absolutely. You definitely can learn these behaviours through the things that you see or the things that you're told. So a lot of us may not have necessarily had direct experiences with things that we fear, but have been taught to.
Yeah. With spiders, for example, it seems to me it's entirely rational to have a fear of spiders because spiders can hurt you.
Well, very rarely.
Shouldn't you be cautious about this?
Yeah, so no, look, I do think caution is – look, I don't like spiders, so I will definitely agree with you 100%.
Aha.
So when we're talking –
now we're getting that. even clinical psychologists have phobias too.
Absolutely. We are not immune. So mostly when it comes to spiders, what you're really thinking is it interfering with my life? So is it dominating my thinking? Is it meaning that I'm not able to do things that I would like to do rather than just, you know, that I don't like spiders and that I'd prefer to avoid them or have someone else squash them if I can?
It's funny that it's fixated on particular things, aren't they? And it can be. It's often is for people who suffer these things. It's specific. It's some particular things, isn't it? I wonder why that is.
Yeah, no. Well, apparently if you went to the people who have a specific phobia, almost half of them will be to bugs.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. So there's something about those creepy little crawlers that we don't like.
I wonder what's going on there. Because that's interesting. So most of them are about bugs, like spiders, insects, ants. All that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cockroaches is one, isn't it? Some people have an irrational fear of cockroaches.
Yeah, and I've had a friend who had one to moths. I think that's not so unusual either.
I'm a bit dodgy around moths, actually. Yeah. I know that's. It's interesting, though, isn't it, as to why that should be the case? Then it's not. I mean, because very few people. I mean, you don't hear about phobias so much to, I don't know, water or sunlight or green grass. I'm talking about phobias rather than allergies, perhaps, or for that matter, you know, common. People aren't usually don't usually have a phobia about cows or sheep, do they?
Well, technically, you can have a phobia to anything. So hydrophobia is known, very rare, but known. So I think it's more whatever interpretation you're capable of making. So we, you know, something about creepy crawlies seems to make us make interpretations that would elevate anxiety. And fear, whereas, say, things that we are exposed to regularly, like water, for example, allows us to be a little bit more realistic about the threat.
Tamara Cavanagh is with us, a clinical psychologist. She's chief executive of the Australian Psychological Society. We're talking about phobias tonight, and we're talking about how they're divided up into three main areas. There's specific phobias like claustrophobia, agoraphobia, fear of dogs, cats, spiders, arachnophobia, and all those things. Then there are social anxiety disorders, sometimes called social phobias, and we'll discuss those again in a minute. And then there are the agoraphobias, which are fears of, you know, being out, about, travelling. Some people, as you know, can't catch trains and so on. So Desmond's got a question about claustrophobia. Yes, Desmond?
Hello?
Hi, Desmond.
How are you going?
Not bad.
I'm over 70 years old.
Yeah.
I think it's claustrophobia. Like, I've had to have a couple of CT scans. I bailed out of that. I just couldn't, go through the machine. I've got off the bed, you know, and just no way in the world could I do that.
Because claustrophobia, just for everyone else, I'm sure most people know this, is a fear of confined spaces, Desmond. So do the scan, you had to put your head or part of your body inside this narrow chamber, and that's the thing you found impossible to do.
Yeah, and same as the aeroplane. I've been in the aeroplane. When I get on the aeroplane, I start shaking. But the funny part about it, I used to work underground in the mine.
Hey, what?
When I was a young man, yeah, machine mining and that, never had any problem with it at all. But later on in my life, oh, my God, even in the car, I'll get in the car, and a lot of times I've just got to stop the car and get out.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What about if you wind the window down or something like that?
If I wind the window down, yeah, I've still got to get out the car, yeah. Stop and get out the car.
What about getting into bed or something like that, Desmond?
Yeah, even when I go to bed at night time, if I don't have a window open, even in the winter, I'm up at 2-3 o'clock in the morning and I've got to go outside the house. Yeah, it's pretty bad, I can tell you.
Yeah, well, it does sound bad, yeah.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if anyone could put a...
Yeah, I don't know, Tamara. You're saying, Desmond, that obviously because, I mean, you'd think a person with claustrophobia, a job down the mine would be the last job in the world that you'd want. But
that's right. Yeah, but I don't know when I was a young man, you know.
Yeah. Tamara, can you develop these things? Well, let's ask Tamara. Tamara, can you develop these things late in life?
Yeah, absolutely. Although if I'd had a client who came to me telling me some of these things, I'd be interested to know whether the fear is of having a panic attack. And whether it's
ask Desmond.
Desmond, is it a fear of having a panic attack in those moments?
Yeah, I think so. Then
we'd be really looking at that, because that would be what's common amongst those scenarios, is that when you're in a tight space or when you're in confined rooms or when you think that there is a lack of oxygen. It's all of those moments. It may possibly be, you know, that it's a fear of panic attacks.
Yeah, right. What's a way forward, I suppose?
Yeah, sure.
So panic attacks are a fear of all the sensations that, you know, you get when you're in certain situations where adrenaline kicks off. And it's usually, which would explain why it would change over time. So that when you're younger, you're able to do things because you haven't yet developed the fear. But when you start to connect those situations to panic attacks, it can develop over time. And if that's the case, our most common treatment for it is cognitive behavior therapy. So it's a therapy that looks at the way you think and feel and how you manage those feelings of anxiety, and then teaches you strategies to calm that down.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So where do you go? See, I live out in a little country town where, you know, it's 200 kilometres to the nearest, either way to the nearest major hospital or to get help like that, you know. So where do you go with that?
Yeah, so we've been really lucky lately. The government has assisted us with telehealth now. So you can speak to a psychologist over the phone, over video, and they will be able to do CBT with you through either video or phone. And all you need is a referral from your GP.
Go and see your GP, Des.
Yeah, all right. Thank you very,
is
very
deep,
much.
Is, and tell you to see, you, tell you'll see the GP, tell the GP you'll see her out in the front lawn.
It's a terrible, terrible feeling.
Oh, I can imagine. Absolutely. Yeah, no, I'm not trying to make light of it, Des. Thank you. Yeah. Well, good luck with it. Yeah, go and see a GP and get a referral. I mean, I'm not trying to make a joke about it, but because for people who suffer these things, so the fear is what is the actual fear, do you think, in the end that people are feeling, or is it just not even able to be described?
So it sort of depends on the situation. So you can imagine a lot of specific phobias, you have a genuine fear. So if it's spiders, it may be, you know, a fear that you'll get bitten, a fear that you'll die. But often we just don't like that feeling of anxiety. We don't like, and we are, you know, biologically predisposed to not like it and to avoid situations that cause it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know for me, for moths, for example, I mean, I don't like the dust off moths. In fact, I have a real dislike of that. I don't like their flapping. I don't like their general mothiness, I must say. Frank, hello. G'day, Frank.
Oh, g'day, mate. How you going?
Not bad.
Yeah, no, I was just listening, waiting for me name. A few months ago.
Yeah.
Less than three.
Hmm.
I won't say where, because it wasn't their fault, but my greatest fear or my greatest nightmare is being buried alive, right?
Okay.
And I had to have an MRI, and it had to be of my head and shoulders. So they put a frame over you to hold your head still.
Yep.
And then they put me in the MRI machine, and everything was going fine for about 7 minutes, and the shot was going to take 18 minutes. And I didn't know, and I couldn't hear, but there was a thunderstorm outside, and the thunderstorm knocked the power out, which stopped the MRI machine, and they couldn't, because that was in gear or whatever it was, they couldn't get me out, for the generator at the establishment was supposed to cut in, and it never cut in. To probably 3 minutes, and I was stuck in the MRI machine. It's still making me shiver, and I'm getting teary even talking about it. And until they got the machine out into a manual situation, and they were able to wheel me out of the machine and get the thing off my head, and I was pretty upset by that time.
Wow,
that sounds terrible.
Yeah,
does talking about it does it bring it back for you, Frank?
Oh shit, yeah.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, you don't have to. No, don't you worry about that. You don't. Yeah, well, I mean, I'm just trying to help you here too.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. It's even tearing me up. Like, I'm nearly 70.
Yeah.
Right, and it's nearly tearing me up now. Right, just talking about it. I don't know whether talking about it will do me any good.
Mm.
Maybe, but I'll never forget it. I know that. But it was worst experience. Like, and I've been around a fair bit. I'm an ex-serviceman and all, and that is the worst experience. I've had snakes within a foot of my face, Brown snake standing up ready to strike within a foot of me face. And that feeling of being stuck in that machine was more frightening than the experience with the snake.
Thanks, Frank. Thanks for sharing that, Frank. I mean, I you know, I don't want to put you through any more, but because I can hear the emotion in your voice. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah, thank you, Tamara. I know I'm probably repeating myself a little here, but what is the actual fear though? What are we afraid of? What's Frank afraid of?
So I mean, everyone's individual, but yeah. It's quite possible that in that case he actually connects that moment to because he mentioned that he had a fear of being buried alive.
That's right.
And so he may have actually connected the two in that moment, and it would have been quite traumatic. So it's essentially our fears can be anything. So it's whatever is the situation that we see as the most threatening. And anything connected to death in particular, or fear of death, is, you know, really anxiety provoking. So in this case, my suggestion would be that it's quite possible that, you know, he drew the link between what was happening in that moment and that he could possibly be, you know, at risk of dying, even though, you know, in a hospital and in a safe scenario, you can see why for someone who has that fear, that would be quite traumatic.
Yeah. Okay. Because one of my texters is, why is it a common thing, small space? I know some people are afraid of big spaces, they're agoraphobics and so on, but the fear of small spaces is very common, isn't it?
Yeah, I
think
it's
Do you think that is that about death, do you think? What do you think it's about?
I think it's about the not being able to escape. So you feel in that moment in a confined space like you can't control what's about to happen, that you can't just get away from it. And when we experience anxiety, one of the strongest responses is avoidance. So I want to get out of this situation or get away from this. And I think those confined spaces give us that sense that that might be restricted in any way, shape or form, and that then we would be stuck there and left with this feeling.
We're talking about phobias. Tamara Cavanagh's my guest, a clinical psychologist, a chief executive of the Australian Psychological Society. Let's talk a bit more about the things we've been talking about are specific phobias. Let's talk about social anxiety disorder called social phobia. Now, people with social anxiety disorder fear situations where they might be humiliated or embarrassed or judged by others. They become particularly anxious when unfamiliar people are involved. This is the common one where people say, my worst fear is not dying. My worst fear is having to get up and make a speech in front of people.
Absolutely.
So I mean, this is as common as anything, isn't it? I mean, for many people, this is their worst possible fear. The idea that they might have to get up in front of a lecture hall or a group of people they don't know and you know, make a speech or say something. What's going on there?
Yeah, so we're just fearing negative evaluation by others. We have a incredible need to be accepted by others, and to not be rejected. And so we put in situations where that might occur. We, you know, tend to really worry about it. We think about it a lot. We tend to replay scenarios, and we really worry about the interpretation that others might make of us.
Okay. How would you deal with things like that?
So, well, in terms of treatment, we usually look at the way someone thinks and we try and get them to perceive situations more realistically. So, you know, we are much more accepting of people than, you know, most might think, that even when we make a negative judgment of someone else, we tend to be able to, you know, put it in perspective and we don't consider it for very long in our minds. So we do tend to spend a lot of time looking at the way people think, and also reducing the amount to which they avoid those situations so that they can learn, even if I am negatively judged or even if something goes wrong, you know, I can cope and I can get through that.
All these things, I mean, you might be listening to us and thinking, oh, well, you know, there can't be many people like that. But, well, according to the Federal Health Department, figures from them in 2019, about 15%, about one in seven, Australians will develop a phobia or anxiety disorder during their lives. I mean, you would see people tomorrow. Is that your sense of it, of how common it is?
No, incredibly common. And they're those that will say that they have it. So we could imagine that it's possibly quite higher. You know, and the recent coronavirus stuff elevates anxiety and makes all of this much more possible.
Mm. Yeah, for example, my dislike of moths, which I must say I'm getting plenty of tech support on, is I don't think it's not a phobia in the sense that it doesn't disable me. I mean, I can be in a room with a moth, but I don't like them. Margie Bear says, I'm with you, Phil. They target me because they know I hate them. They go for me in a room of 10 people. Margie Bear, I know that's irrational, but I kind of agree with you in lots of ways too. But I think that's just because we are a bit sensitive to them. AJ says, my wife has major panic attacks and anxiety every Sunday night before she goes back to work. She even cries. When I ask her why, she's anxious. She can't tell me. But on the day of work, she's fine. She loves it. We've tried CBT and it hasn't helped. Any suggestions?
Oh, so I guess the issue is that I really want to, you know, get to know what goes on for her.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
What is it that she's thinking that night before? And, you know, what, you know, other than work, what happens? What does she connect with the two? Is there something particular about Sunday? So I think it's really useful when you see a psychologist to not just, you know, just stick to, you know, CBT or one particular treatment, but to actually sit there and work until you get to the bottom of it, of what's going on all around it, before, during and after. And I think that really usually gives you a lot of information, because it can be that the CBT has targeted, you know, just an incorrect little moment there, and it might have been something else.
Mm. Yeah, we're talking about cognitive behaviour therapy, aren't we? CBT. We'll talk a bit about some therapies in a moment. My guest is Tamara Cavanagh. What triggers a phobia? As we've already discovered, you can develop them at almost any stage in life, can you? As well as inherit them, it seems.
Yes, yes. And children, you know, we all know commonly have phobias such as the dark, or, you know, all sorts of phobias that are common when you're a child. And they do grow out of them. And then others you can develop through experiences that you have across your lifetime.
Yeah. Okay. Do we know what causes them?
Not directly.
If you're developing them in your lifetime?
Yeah, not directly. Usually most people would know, you know, these kind of events stand out in their memory. But sometimes it can be as simple as you had a panic attack in a moment, your brain drew a connection that you may not necessarily obviously recall.
Mm. Someone's suggesting on the text line, is there a link between autism and Asperger's and social anxieties?
So we do know that people who suffer with autism do have a higher incidence of having an anxiety disorder in general, and I, you know, certainly social anxiety is one of them. So we do know that the two are connected,
but not specifically how they're just connected.
Just occur more frequently.
Yeah.
So you know whether that can be for a whole range of reasons, but it, you know, it's just the incidence seems to be, you know, run higher in those who suffer autism.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, apart from inheriting it, you can develop a phobia from a direct experience, can't you? I mean, if you're bitten by a spider, you may become arachnophobic as a result.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as you can with a dog bite, that kind of thing. So a negative experience that you then connect to other things can very much be one of the things that develop into a specific phobia.
Mm. In life, Tamara, we generally navigate our way around to make life as pleasant as possible. And that means avoiding things which we are uncomfortable about. I mean, all of us do this, don't we?
Absolutely.
You would say it's a phobia when we're finding our path that we're navigating is so complicated because we're trying to avoid situations that it's interfering with our day-to-day activities. Then that's when you think maybe it's a phobia, not just a dislike.
Yeah, so whenever it's interfering with function, so, you know, all the things that you want to do in your life, that's the moment when we would say, so that this is potentially getting to the point of being a phobia. It's getting in the way of the things that you want to do.
Are people who have phobias aware that they've got one? Or do they think, look, it's just that you don't understand how dangerous spiders are. It's your problem, not mine.
I think it can be a bit of both. So, you'll often have family members who will go, your response to this is excessive, or your fear of this is greater than most people's. But a lot of the time, people do know that they have a specific phobia, and some, may choose not to approach it. Arachnophobia is a good example. You might just choose, that so long as it's not interfering in everything you want to do, you're happy to just avoid spiders.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Doug, hello.
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi, Doug.
Yeah, how are you going? This
Not
is
bad.
a good discussion tonight. I'm enjoying every bit of it.
Thank you.
I have claustrophobia, and it seemed to develop after I was working underneath a building, and I got caught up. I couldn't work out how to get out again, and ever since then, this claustrophobia has been. About I don't work now, I'm retired, but a little while ago we had a problem. We'd gone to bed and the lock on the bedroom door jammed and I couldn't get it undone, and I started, even in that bedroom, that big bedroom, I started to get into a panic. I had to really take control and think it out and work out what I could do. And when I had an MRI, I had to have one. I was fine till they told me I was going to be in there for 40 minutes.
Oh, dear.
And they put me in the first time and I had to get out. Anyway, they said, well, most people can't do it if they can't do it the first time. And I went in the second time, and because I'd done years of yoga, I thought, really, I should be able to manage this. And I used my yoga breathing. And I got myself calmed down, and I really got myself quite relaxed in the end. But every time, if I've got to have a CAT scan or anything, I have to get the doctor to give me something to get me through it.
Yeah.
But so I just wanted to add that to it. But I don't know if there's
do you
a
feel
way
it's
out.
Getting, do you feel it's getting better as you get older, Doug, or staying the same, or getting worse?
No, I think it's getting worse. I'm at nearly 70. I think it's getting worse. I have techniques now to deal with it. Like, I don't have a problem with standing up in front of 100 people and playing the guitar, but to do it, I make sure I've got all my ducks in a row, that I've got everything under control, I've got everything I need, I know what I'm going to do, and that's how I manage those things. But the bedroom thing, getting nearly to a panic because of that was a bit of a surprise. I didn't think that I was as bad as that, and this is only a few months ago. So I had nothing I could do.
How did you? Do you mind me asking, Doug? How did you talk yourself down?
Well, I had to think about the fact that I wasn't under any threat, and just slow my breathing down. One of the yoga techniques is to breathe out deeply instead of all this fast breathing. Just slow the breathing down, slow it down. A few sighing out breaths, I started to think it out, what I could do. And in the end, I worked out how I could get this door open. And and being an old tradie, I managed to invent a way of dealing with it. But I couldn't get out the windows because they were security windows.
Yep.
I couldn't get out the door because the door was, the lock had stuck. And my phone wasn't in the room. And this was the middle of the night. So, but I managed to deal with it.
Yeah.
So.
Thanks for sharing, Doug.
Okay. Thanks. Well, that's a great discussion. It's always good on the way home.
Good on
you,
mate.
Monday night. Thank you, mate.
Thanks, Doug. Bye bye. No, I appreciate it. 1-300-800-222. A number of callers have wanted to know this, Tamara. What Doug suffered from? What is a panic attack? What's going on in a panic attack?
Yeah. So a panic attack is an adrenaline shot. So that's essentially in the body. That's what you're experiencing. So you get a racing heart, shortness of breath, dry mouth, sometimes nausea, you know, increase in blood pressure, shaking, trembling, chest pain, tightness in the chest, dizziness, lightheadedness, sweating. So they're all symptoms of a panic attack. And essentially at the end of the day, it's the body responding to threat. So it's sending off adrenaline and getting itself prepared to fight and goes into that fight or flight mode. So, and then it's about what we connect that to. So in the case of specific phobias, we can connect that to an object or a situation, you know, such as, you know, confined spaces or that kind of thing.
Let's talk about some treatments. I mean, one of the more common things I understand for particular phobias, I mean, if you're afraid of spiders, for example, or have, sorry, not afraid of, but have a phobia about spiders, there's a thing called exposure therapy, and that is I'll gradually expose you to spiders until you have lost your fear of them. Is this effective?
Yeah, no. So it's one of the top treatments. So we usually do it, you know, in a very graded and slow way and in a very particular way. But we're looking at trying to get you to learn that the thing that you're worried about, you know, is not something that you need to worry about. So it depends on what it is. And, you know, just get you to the point where you can do all the things that you want to do. So in the case of spiders, you might not necessarily get to the point where you're happy to have a spider crawling on your arm, but you can, you know, go out into the garden and do the things that you want to do in your day.
Hmm. So this is quite effective, is it? Because I can imagine many people thinking, you know, that's like pouring, you know, acid on a cut. It's just going to make it worse. It's going to irritate the symptom rather than actually ameliorate it. But you're saying it doesn't do that. It does work.
No, so it absolutely works. So the very thing that we do whenever we have a fear, and everyone will have done it, you know, to something else in their life. You know, one of the biggest ones is driving. The first time you get in a car, you feel a lot of anxiety about, you know, driving anywhere. And then as you do it day after day, you suddenly relax. And the next thing you know, you find you can get from A to B with very little thought. So, you know, in the same way that we do for driving or your first day at a new job, across time, your anxiety tends to lower when you do things repeatedly. So, you know, cognitive behavior therapy is just teaching skills to people around how to reduce their fear and how to slowly confront it in a way that will reduce their anxiety. I think Doug gave an excellent example that he had inadvertently done to manage his anxiety. So we usually do a lot of techniques as well as the slow confronting of the situation.
Mm. Okay, Jeff, you've got a fear of heights. Hi, Jeff.
G'day, mate. How are you? Long time listener, first time caller.
Good on you. Good on you. Good on you.
I used to do abseiling when I was younger, and I'm in my late 50s now, and I've developed this massive fear of heights, to the point where if I'm watching a YouTube or TV and someone's on top of a building, I've got to turn the TV off.
Really?
So yeah. I'm wondering if I go back to start to abseil again, will that reteach my brain again?
It can do, but you might actually find it easier to go a little bit slower and just spend some time just watching that on TV and just so doing a few things that are steps along the way that might make it easier so that you've got, you know, a calmer frame of mind when you go into it.
Because it's like pins and needles in my legs and, It's the weirdest thing, and I don't understand where it came from.
Do you find, Jeff, I used to be, when I was a student years ago, I had a, you know, casual job as a window cleaner on tall buildings. This was back in the day when, you know, OH&S didn't really exist.
A rope and a bucket.
That's right. It was basically a rope and a bucket, and I was given a key to the windows, which you could open, and there was a ledge, you know, and they said, I think the supervisor said, be careful, you know, I'm still here, but there's no way in the known universe I could do that now. There's no way. Yeah. I mean, Tamara, is that, do we, when we get older, do we generally get a bit more fearful, do you think, or not?
Well, I think it's possible. We've had more exposure to situations that would trigger fear, and we're more aware of our own mortality. So I think it's quite possible. I'm not aware of research that says one way or the other, because obviously children experience phobias quite commonly.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't surprise me that we would become a little bit vulnerable given our experiences across time.
Jeff, don't abseil straight away. That seems to be tomorrow's.
Take it slowly. And, you know, if it's something you really want to do, go, you know, you can go see a psychologist. They'll be able to help you work through that and so that you get back to really enjoying it.
All right. Good on you, Jeff. Thanks very much, guys.
On you, Jeff. Bye-bye. Yeah, appreciate it. 1-300-800-222. Greg, hello. G'day, Greg.
Greg, yeah, how you going?
Yeah, good. You used to fly planes.
Yeah, I was just
Can't do it now?
No, I was a recreational pilot, but I got a navigation thing to add to it, so I could pretty much fly anywhere, you know, in controlled airspace and stuff like that. Anyway, one weekend down at Bunbury, I was coming into land. I got slightly distracted, and it sort of bounced the what they call ballooning down that runway, and I took off again, and I couldn't get my head around it. Once I got in the air, I thought, you know, I got this massive fear. That's it. I'm gone. You know what I mean? It's all over. I'm finished. I'm dead, you know, because I couldn't get it back on the ground. And I came around. I managed to get it back on the ground, which is all right, you know. And it took me a while to work out what I'd actually done wrong, and I sort of worked it out. But I've tried to go again since, but I haven't been able to go by myself. I haven't been able to get them skills back. And I've been with friends who fly, and they tell me, oh, hey, you can do it, you can do it. But then all of a sudden, I can't do it. You know, 1 minute I can do it, the next minute I can't do it. You know, I'll come in, I'll do 10 good landings, and then I just freeze up, you know what I mean, and just get overwhelmed with fear, you know what I mean, and it overcomes you, right? So I tend not to, I don't do it by myself now, so I'm just wanting. And I have a passion for flying. I love it. I've loved it since I was a kid. I mean, I only got my pilot's license when I was about just over 50 years old, so pretty late. But
Greg, it's not being up at 20,000 feet. It's not a fear of running out of fuel or your engine stopping. It's just the landing. It's how will I put this on the back on the ground?
Yeah, yeah. Because when I fly in the plane, I take off and everything like it doesn't faze me. I'll go off and I'll be with someone who I'll just fly.
Yeah.
And then, you know, fly around. I can hide, help, you know, keep my height good, you know, you've got to stay within a certain height and stuff like that. You know, the crawling, coming into Janicol, all that's fine. But, yeah, I just found lately it's just seems to be getting worse. You know what I mean? My fear is getting worse, not better. And I thought that if I kept doing it, because once I worked out what I'd done, I thought, oh, well, that's why I'd done it. I should have just landed and taken off again and proved to myself I could do it instead of almost getting out of the plane and kissing the ground, thinking, I don't want to do this again, I'm done, you know. So I think I put that fear into myself and I haven't been able to get it back out again. So it's a concern because I do like flying.
Sure. Tamara, what do you think about that?
Yeah, so when I have clients who I see, you know, mention very similar things, I've done something repeatedly, but my fear doesn't seem to be dropping. And I often say to them, it is a little bit more complicated than just slowly confronting something or confronting it repetitively. It's really working out what the individual fear is on and then targeting that in a graded way in our treatment. So, you know, it's that question of when flying, what's the element of greatest fear and really working that through. And then it's adding in the slow confronting of that. So, you know, my recommendation would be, you know, to sit down with a psychologist, you know, go specifically, I really want to get back to flying. And, you know, I would like that. I don't want to miss out. You know, this is something I used to love and I want to work out why, despite doing it repeatedly, I'm not getting what we call habituation to the fear.
Yeah. So, and of course, the fear overwhelms you and then you can't do anything. You know, you go blank, basically. Mm. But I did try hypnotherapy, but, I mean, I felt great when I come out of hypnotherapy. I was on cloud nine, basically, and then just flowed along. Thought, oh, this is great, you know. But then I went not long after that. And, yeah, it was still there, so psychologist,
you say. Yeah, so because it depends on what you're fearing. It you know, may possibly be that you're fearing that you would freeze up and that you wouldn't necessarily have control in that moment, and that might be what the fear is on. If that's the case, just doing it repeatedly you know, may not target the fear itself. So that's why, you know, earlier I sort of mentioned that it's very individual and often, you know, quite technical, the parts that you target.
Mm.
Yeah. All right. Okay, thanks very Greg. Much. I really appreciate it. Good talk tonight. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Greg. Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, what Greg's experiencing then is what is the panic attack, which is you, which is what you're saying, Tamara, is this would be just a dump of adrenaline.
Yeah. So it'd be and often repeated adrenaline.
Yeah.
So as you have each fear thought, the adrenaline shot gets higher, and then with that you get more of your fight and flight symptoms and more of your panic symptoms.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So is what you're saying with the therapeutic approach is to try and unpick the anxiety into the smallest pieces you can and say, what's the actual fear here? What am I actually afraid of is going to happen?
Yeah.
And then try and rationally unpick that and say, well, look, you know, if you think about it in this way, that can't happen. And get yourself to accept that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so it's very much drilling down to what the individual fear is on, and mm-hmm. even the same specific phobia, a person could fear more than one element, or could fear, two people could fear different elements. So, you know, it's about drilling down to that fear, and then it's about looking at how you perceive that and then changing those thoughts and learning techniques to be able to modify your interpretation of that threat.
Mm. Mm.
And then slowly confronting it so that you can learn, no, I don't need to fear that to the level that I was.
Yeah. Okay, Lynn's texted me saying, I had a big fear of flying. My family encouraged me to participate in a flight without fear course at the airport over 6 weeks. We were exposed each week to the airport. Over this time, it reduced the dread I had. We spoke to pilots, aircraft crew. We boarded a plane that wasn't going anywhere. We heard the engine start up. Had all the noises explained, and this reduced the anxiety. A psychologist spoke to us each week and taught us skills to lessen our anxiety. It was a good result. The group took a graduation flight at the conclusion of the course. A few months later, I flew to London. Wow. Good on you, Lynn. So, I mean, there are ways through it, in other words.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think she gave a really good description of exactly how it works and how a psychologist can help.
Yeah. Leonie's in Atherton in Queensland. Hi, Leonie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
Look, I'm finding this a really interesting discussion tonight, and I've got a bit of a confession to make.
Mm.
I actually sent a text in and then I decided to call on a different matter.
Mm-hmm.
The text was to asking the question whether there's been a greater, have you noticed, Tamara, that there's a lot more phobia becoming evident since the COVID virus? I'm certainly noticing that a lot of people I know seem to be panicking, if you want to put it that way, about lots of things, not necessarily the virus, but people who wouldn't normally panic before about quite simple things are. And I'll just...
Tamara?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think we are experiencing a generally increased level of anxiety, and that makes us more generally fearful at a base level, and then things that wouldn't bother us are starting to activate us a little bit more. There's also some talk of a coronaphobia, so, you know, that there are people who have a fear that's out of proportion.
I think that's definitely out there. That is definitely out there, isn't it, Tamara? There are people who, I'm not saying you oughtn't be concerned about coronavirus, but there are many people in the community who probably should be less concerned about than others in the sense of the personal danger that it represents for them.
Yeah.
Well, I'm 75, and I'm what's nowadays called comorbidity,
mm-hmm.
But I'm not terrified of it, just sensible about it. But I've found that I'm not wanting to go out anywhere. Every time I plan to go out, I come up with an excuse of why I don't need to go out.
Mm.
So I suppose that's a kind of phobia. But actually what I called about was thank you so much, Tamara, for explaining panic attacks. People of my generation didn't really know about panic attacks until I think the first time I heard of a panic attack, it wasn't called that, it was called it. and it included something, people breathing into brown paper packets. And that was about 30 years ago. But your explanation has made me realise and put together things that I, after listening to you, I had myself almost convinced that I'm not anacrophobic. However, when you started talking about the therapy, it crept me out completely. And I can trace that back now because you said children can have panic attacks.
You think it came back from childhood, Leonie?
Well, going to the movies. Yeah. When I was a child, we weren't protected as much as children are now. And some movies...
I'll have to be a bit brief here, Leonie, because we're running out of time. But
oh, yeah. Okay. Tarzan. I saw a native bearer bitten by a spider.
Oh, okay.
And it kept coming back to this lump on his arm.
Oh, dear. I know, Leonie, we'll have to leave it because we have run out of time. But I'm sorry about that because I didn't want to interrupt your story. But anyway, Tamara, the point is there is help. It's cognitive behaviour therapy and exposure therapies are quite effective. Thanks for your time, Tamara.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.